Accession number 33891.
Reel 5.
Gary Garrett, reel 5.
Right. Doing a bit of recap on the start of the flying training. The two little things that we covered, Edwin didn't cover. One is I had my first experience of low flying, something that is illegal. You should never low fly without permission. But this was just to show you what could happen, the sort of things to watch for if you're caught under the weather or something like that. And we did 1 hour and 5 minutes of night flying, which I suppose was a good experience. The only thing is my instructor was a bit crazy because I never found out, but I assumed all the instructors were ex-operational pilots who were then given their rest period to do this sort of thing. And I think he was bored stiff because on our one and only night flying experience, he did a loop in the dark. Mm. So that was good, wasn't it? night flying, loop the loop. That was scary, but interesting.
What was your vision like then at night?
Oh, it was pretty good. I mean, I can't remember whether we had much moon or not, but landing at night was done with what we call gooseneck flares. These are like large containers of paraffin, I believe it's paraffin, with a spout sticking out and a wick. And these are lit along the side of the runway. And of course, the trouble with sitting with those on the snow, I would imagine after a long time, they'll be start to sink in. I don't know, because we only did an hour and 5 minutes each, and then we were on our way to the next one at Carberry to start flying the Anson.
And you mentioned low flying. What's the kind of sensation between low flying and
well, it was good. It was great fun. You know, you see things whistling by. He took me down a valley where you could look up and see deer scrambling along the side of the hill. At least I assume they would do it. Well, they were certainly wild animals on the hillside, but that was quite interesting. But as I say, it's all part of having fun while you're doing work, isn't it?
And with low flying, you get a real sensation of the speed.
Oh, yes, of course. But then the Anson wasn't very fast, I think maybe 100 miles an hour. I can't remember the exact speed, but it's not a very fast aircraft, of course. It's designed for training. It's obviously is not designed for high speeds.
So with the Anson, obviously, when you moved on to Carberry, the issue with the Anson is, how did they start your training there? Does it start in the same way as
it started exactly the same way? Lots, a bit of ground school stuff, and then walk into the aircraft, round the aircraft, talking all the instruments, showing you what to do, and explaining how to wind the handle to get the undercarriage up, which was extremely important because you didn't raise the undercarriage automatically. You had to wind a handle to bring it up on the Anson. And of course, we began to get some navigational training too on the ground, because once we started flying and got up to the point, well, initially, let's go back a little. Each instructor had four pupils, and two in the morning and two in the afternoon. And on the alternative times, you were in the ground school. When you were flying together, one of you would be sitting in the pilot seat, left-hand seat, the instructor on the right, and the other one at the back listening, and then halfway through that exercise, you change place, the two pilots. And then it got to a point when you started doing a bit of cross-country work, where the chap in the back was the navigator, and then, you know, told you when to turn to get you back to base eventually. And then eventually, when you did it together, the two of you, one with the navigator and one with the pilot. And it slowly developed that way, so you got more and more experience. But here again, the instructor took us on a low-flying experience trip across the prairies. And seeing all what was about to become wheat in the ground, it's quite interesting, because it's dead flat. And roads running north and south or east and west. It was like a crosswalk patch almost. And it was good fun all the way around as far as the flying training concerned, but the hard part was that you knew that at the end of the course, the top third in the final exams, that was ground exams, would become officers, and the other two thirds would become sergeant pilots. Always puzzles me is that fact, because in other words, two thirds of aircrew pilots were NCOs. And I don't remember ever seeing a film where you saw a sergeant pilot. They're all officers. And it gives the very wrong impression, very wrong impression. But we lost 9 bods on the way. We started the original 60 that had left ACRC together, had stayed together. We lost 1 at the EFTS, and we lost another 8 at Carberry, so there was 51 of us graduated.
What was the main reasons?
Oh, in most cases, lack of coordination, not being able to, that business of not being made to that, you know, that little extra touch that you can hold off the ground. How the instructing officers made these decisions, at what point they said it, but we did lose. And they went off to other schools, either to become air gunners or navigators.
So is it a sense, really, with that? Do you get a feel for flying?
I think so, yes. You get to a point where I mean, after all, at the end of the day, I had over 5,000 hours, but I think you get to a point where it becomes almost a natural instinct. You don't have to, you're not concentrating, really. It's coming to you as though it should be there. It's like you should be doing it, and you're doing it quite, it's like you drive a car. When you start driving a car, it's all nerves, you're very careful. Once you're an experienced driver, you relax, but keep your eyes open and watch out for the odd problem.
So is it a sense that you don't actually think about what you're doing with your hands and your feet?
No, you begin to do it automatically. It begins to, you know, for me anyway, and I assume for all the other pilots. But no, I found towards the end of that course, I was beginning to enjoy what I was doing rather than having to work at what I was doing.
Can I ask you about a little bit about the navigation? Because obviously, you know, aircraft navigation has completely changed these days.
Oh, yes.
Well, how did you do it?
It was all dead recognition. Well, before you took off, you would, excuse me, make out the flight plan. And then the instructor would say, well, we're going to take off. I want you to go to so-and-so. And then we would turn and go to so-and-so. And then turn and come back. We'll see how well you get. So the navigator would work out the course. Now, he would work it out based on the Met forecast from the Met Office wind. But obviously, it's never 100%. So if you're about 10 miles an hour winds off, you're going to be moving off all the time. So you have to make the corrections. Later, we learned out how to work out the wind, but that's rather a complicated thing. So it was up to the navigator to do the plotting in such a way that when we arrived, he said, well, home and base, you look out and there was base sort of thing. And it was, you could get lost occasionally when we were on our own, and that's when the you could never really get truly lost, because the railway line from Trans-Canada was just north of the border, so you did all your trips up north, and if you got lost, you came down to found the railway line, dropped down and flew around the first grain elevator you could see, read it off, climbed up, and you knew where you were. But I think that was done occasionally.
So with the navigation in those days as well, you would use observing the ground as well?
Observing the ground, or dead reckoning. Well, you might do it in cloud, of course, but you're working to dead reckoning and you're flying on the instruments. And you turn as instructed by the navigator. When you get onto the next school, you'll understand that a little more, but that'll come later. Anyway, at the end of the course, as I said, the top 17, or the top third, and that was 17 of 51. I came 17th on the ground, and I have my logbook which reads above average pilot. But there was a gentle hint made by my instructor that Abraham and a Cockney accent weren't going to go down too well in the officer's mess, so I became a sergeant pilot. And we moved on to the next school.
Did you at Carberry, did you do any formation flying?
Yes, oh yes. I have, in fact, in my Elwyn, I have a picture which took a formation flying. That was quite interesting, and I suppose the only time you really had to work hard. But again, after a while, it became natural.
How do you achieve it?
It's purely a case of, for me, it was a case of, once you were in position, noting, shall we say, where the aerial of the aircraft or the roundel of the wing or something lined up with where I was, and holding it and making sure that I kept my vision all lined that way. We didn't fly too close, obviously, because we were amateurs, and it was quite way out. But it was a case of concentration. And really, formation flying depends more on the front man, because he's got to hold the aircraft dead straight, and he starts weaving, you've got to weave to catch him up. And you don't know he's going to weave until he's weaved. So it's the front man who's got the hardest job.
So is it essentially then, really, again, getting your eye into how that aircraft is flying?
Yes.
and holding that position?
Yeah, yes, and that's it with your eye. And later on, I'll be talking about how we did it in B-29s with gun sights to keep the distance. But that was on a special trip, which I'm going to say we'll get round to that when we get up to B-29s. Anyway, we moved on, and we were told all that 40 odd of us, roughly 40, were sent back home or moved on, and 25 of us were told we were going to the General Reconnaissance School at Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, where we will be taught dead reckoning navigation over the sea, because eventually we were going on to coastal command. That's what we were told. When we got to Charlottetown in Prince Edward Island, flying Ansons, we weren't going to be going on to coastal command. We were trained as staff pilots. And what happened at Charlottetown, the Anson would take off with two navigators, trainee and recently qualified, and the whole idea was to fly them over the water so they did dead reckoning navigation to make sure they had nothing to look out to see where they were. It all had to be done. And to come back to base on time. But to do that, the pilot up front couldn't navigate. He had to have it up in his head, of course. So if people were making mistakes, it was up to him to keep things right. And here, I don't know whether you know the difference between the compass and the magnetic compass. Well, when you look at a compass in an aircraft, you are never really looking at the north. Because the first thing is that the aircraft creates deviation, the magnetic field of that aircraft, and that varies depending on the heading you're sitting in. So all aircraft are swung on the ground. You heard the term swing the compass, which they did in ships, for the same reason. So you sit on the ground and somebody sits way behind you with a hand compass, and you turn through the 45 degrees and record what's there, and then you're told what the difference is, and you make it, and there's a card in that aircraft telling you what the deviation is. So from your compass, you have deviation, which then gives you the magnetic heading. That's where the compass is. But the magnetic north is not the north. It's a magnetic north. And at Charlottetown, the variation between north and magnetic north was 25 degrees. You can try and imagine. Let's imagine you're at a place, shall we say, like Toronto, okay, and the magnetic north and the North Pole all in a straight line if you drew a line. Then swing round to the coast, then the gap between the two has widened, and at 25 degrees. In UK at that time, I believe it was about 8. Put that the wrong way round, and you're 50 degrees off course, and it happened occasionally. But there was an easy way to remember it. It was a good advert. Cadbury's Dairy Milk's very tasty. Compass, deviation, magnetic, variation, true. And that's the way we used to remember it. And the other way to remember it is the magnetic variation west, magnetic best, variation east, magnetic least. And as I say, when you're doing the actual flight, the pilot doing the actual flying, had to keep his head about him. And of course, at the end of the day, if they got really lost, he could call up base and get a bearing from them, or even fly the beam back if he could find a beam. But what happened was, when we got there, we were going to be trained as staff pilots, because the Canadians wanted to open a general reconnaissance school a little further along the island, a place called Summerside, and we were going to go there as the staff pilots for them, which was a bit frustrating, and we were told we'd be there for 6 months and then we'd go home. So we moved to Summerside to do this job, flying near Anson 5s, which had a retractable undercarriage. It was just the same, the job as I've explained, and at the end of the 6 months we thought, right, that's it. Oh no, back to Summerside, back to Charlottetown, where we took over the staff pilots that were there and relieved them, and they went home. And so we did all of us, the whole 20 odd of us who did that for years. By the time we'd finished, I think we actually finished up at Charlottetown, where was it? Excuse me, Bonbon. We arrived at Charlottetown the first time round in July 42, and we left in January 44. That was 2 years of the war had gone. We were just flying ants. Mind you, we got all the flying experience, and some of the odd things that happened, a few fun stories. There was one occasion when I was flying one of these new Mark 5s, and the hydraulics failed, and we had to do a belly landing, which was quite interesting. Charlottetown had a very odd runway. It was quite on a slope, and at the bottom of the slope was a pig farm on the other side of the fence, which is quite amusing. And the landing on this particular occasion was downhill, but it went off quite well. We just came in a rather flatter approach and just dumped it, and we skidded along, got out no trouble at all. There was one character who landed on an ice floe out on the Hudson Bay, because remember, Prince Edward Island is right in the southern tip, shall we say, of the Hudson Bay, which is quite a huge area. And during the winter, the ice can form there, and he'd done a forced landing there. Fortunately, at Charlottetown, there was a de Havilland owned by a private company that had ski attachments when required, and they went out and picked the crew up, brought them back. So that was the thing.
When you make your belly landing, you mentioned you come in at slightly.
Well, you make a flatter approach, so that when you hit the ground, you're sort of not coming down quite so much. Or the angle of descent, in other words, is less, and therefore less impact on when you hit the ground. At least, I was given instructions. Of course, I'd never done it before, and we'd never practiced it before, but the senior pilot on the ground would tell me, you know, make a low, flat approach as you can, try and keep your nose up. Gave me full instructions, and it went off quite well, so we got away from that.
Do you switch the engine off as well?
Only as soon as you touch down, you switch. There's another story that'll come later on about that one too, but not at Charlottetown. And there was one occasion too when, before we got the fives, my two trainee navigators were Poles, and on their very first trip, Polish navigators. And on their very first trip, I said, you do know how to wind up the undercarriage? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good, so we got airborne. I said, all right, undercarriage up. And just in front of the handle for the undercarriage is the trim. And he grabbed that and started winding it, which made it very difficult to hold the aircraft till I said, stop, and retrim the aircraft. Another fun thing, Canadians, like the Brits, had the war loan campaign, you know, buy bonds for war. And they were having one in Charlottetown, the town itself. And we were asked to do a formation flight over during a parade that they were holding. And one of the characters, there were five aircraft, and decided to have a bit of fun. And the Anson has a little flap on the door, which you put your hand through to grab the handle, to turn the handle on the outside. He'd pushed a broom handle through it with a roll of toilet paper on it. And as we went over the parade, the war unwound and floated gently to the ground. And the next day, the newspaper said, made out of the comments and said, we do hope that the demonstration roar from the Royal Air Force doesn't indicate what they really think of Charlottetown. I thought it was rather nice. And of course, we had learned a lot of instrument flying, because quite often you went off and you found you were flying in cloud, just as well, because it's dead reckoning navigation. Sometimes the forecast was so badly wrong you have to come back. Again, I remember an occasion when we were all returning to base there. We used to take off about 12 aircraft at a time, one after the other, doing a similar exercise, so we were all following each other. These exercises could be to a point and back again, or they could be what we called creeping line ahead, where you would, as though you were searching for something, or a square search, where you started at the point and slowly got your squares bigger and bigger, as though you were looking for something. We also did ship recognition, went round the harbours to teach navigators to estimate the size of ships and things like that. But this particular occasion, 12 of us all came back because we were icing up. And I and another went into the Met man and said, well, you know, your forecast is all wrong. We've had to come back. No, he said, not possible. It's not on the map. So I said, but look at the aircraft just in front of you and watch them chipping the ice off the leading edge. And it wasn't on the map, so we were obviously wrong. But he saw the point when he saw the ice actually coming off the wings. It happens.
The question with instrument flying as well, I mean, is it a case when you initially start to use your instruments, is it a case that sometimes your body can be telling you that the aircraft is doing something else?
Oh yeah, you do get that feeling occasionally, particularly after a turn. It's something you could try yourself. Next time you're sitting as a passenger in a car, and so you're going to come up to a left-hand bend, you close your eyes, and when he's finished going round the bend, you'll most likely feel that you're going to the right, because the gunge in your ear is still moving backwards and forwards. Well, the same in the aircraft. You get that feeling that you're moving when it's purely the gunge in your ear that's doing, so you must follow your instruments all the time. And of course, with instrument flying, some of them are mechanical, like the artificial horizon, and some are gyroscopic, so you have to be taught how to cope when either of those fail, and you return purely to what we'd call manual control. Like, one of the things was a little spirit level with the ball, so that if the spirit level showed the ball was moving off or left, that was your guide. Another one was a sort of pendulum, something like you get underneath the clock, and if that's moving after flying. So you'd be using things like that, and of course your altimeter seldom went. But then if the pitot head, which is the thing that sticks out the front of the aircraft, iced up, then you'd lose your altimeter and you'd lose speed. So you had to learn to fly with instruments without these things. And later on, when the RAF started introducing instrument rating tests, all these things were tried while you were doing your test. But you learned over the sea on this particular occasion because you flew summer and winter.
And if you, when you were flying like that, you mentioned obviously that you were keeping a running touch, kind of always a running touch of where you are navigationally. Would you allow, as the pilot then, a little bit of error for them to
you would always allow the error. You'd lay on them until they realised that something had gone wrong, and then they would say, look, we've done something wrong here, and you could advise. I had one beautiful occasion in those days. You never lost your piece of service equipment because you put your number on it. I had the usual leather hat for the earphones, and on the back was the last three of my airman's number, which in those days was 162. So you can picture, we're out in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and down somewhere south is the island, and I said, well, you've made a mistake, you know you've got to go south, what do you want to do? He said, I know, let's steer your last three and we'll see what happens. Because the navigator's sitting behind me, so I said, right, turned on to 162 and we came smack over the airfield. Bit of luck. But you could always call up the airfield and say, and get bearing from them. They could pick up your signal, read it, and tell you you're heading. So you could never get totally lost.
And would you sometimes have to wait until they made, if they made say a catastrophic error? Would you at that point intervene?
Yes, only if it was going to take you to a point where you're not supposed to fly, like up the River St. Lawrence sort of thing, and that never happened. And also if it was going to take you too far to Quebec, towards the Quebec border. There's an interesting thing here. It's a rumour, there was a rumour on the island and I think many parts of Canada, that the French Canadians, who were sympathetic to Pétain, were watching out for U-boats, and when they came, they could come in and they would replenish them with food and what have you. Now, I personally don't believe it, but there was one U-boat up the St. Lawrence ship, the Sanker ship, and the entrance to the St. Lawrence River, which is up in the sort of top left-hand corner of Hudson's Bay. So the U-boats got that far. And because of that, several of the aircraft flying would carry depth charges. Not all. When we only had one chap drop a depth charge on what he thought was a sub, And when the reconnaissance went out and looked at it, it was a dead whale. But he'd seen something grey in the water and he'd killed it. But other than that, it was good training, particularly for the chaps who were then going to go on to coastal command, which we never did, or at least I never did.
Was it to a certain extent, do you think, at that time that there might have been a bottleneck in the kind of process?
Oh, yes. That will be demonstrated a little later on. There was a bottleneck, quite definitely. Too many bods trying to do the same thing.
Now, you mentioned a little bit, obviously, about the icing in winter. Was there any specific elements with the weather?
Well, of course, it's Canada on the east coast. The weather there can be pretty cold. You're not too far from the North Pole. And the main trouble is, as I think I mentioned earlier, was super cool water droplets. I don't know whether I talked about that. Well, what can happen if you're flying in cloud and the temperature is just above freezing and it's got rain in the cloud? If you get to a point where suddenly you'll just go below freezing, the aircraft is colder because it's flying, and it gets as though it's a flying fridge. When it hits the rain, these raindrops turn into ice almost automatically as they hit you, and that is where you drop down as rapidly as you can to get into warmer temperature, depending if you can, or you turn around and get out. And of course, you can, in flying in cloud, if you haven't been warm, might be flying into cumulonimbus, which is thunderstorms, but never happened at Charlottetown that I can recall. I seldom had to dodge those sort of things, even later, but we learned how to fly in all sorts of weather, and it was good experience, because of several of them that chaps no doubt went on to civil airliners after, because none of us really saw a war as war is usually expected.
So, in a sense, then, that period of time for yourself, though, you were gaining an awful lot of flying hours.
A lot of flying hours, a lot of experience. Well, I think when I got back to the UK, I got about 1,500 hours flying in here. But the trip back to the UK is quite interesting, because that was done in a Dakota. Break.